Okay, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. A minute past the hour, and we begin this Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Now I can say, a week from tonight, we will be finishing up with the month of February, because my ciphering and Gazetta's were no good last night. But a week from tonight, we will finish up with the month of February. This is the 23rd day. Please don't tell me I'm getting it wrong again. This is Tuesday, the 23rd day of February, 2016. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump into the Horn chat room, where the madcap merriment has already gotten underway. The real-time extravaganza that is the Horn chat room. Good evening to Devin and Jug of Punch and King of Cups and Little Gray and Texas Tea and Tim from L.A. And a good evening to our moderators this evening. Longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderators, Sparky and Texas Betsy. Texas Betsy doesn't moderate very often because, well, I mean, not a lot of time. But they're both there, and Sparky, being a third-stage guild navigator, has folded space to become Man Cave. So y'all behave in there. Yes, indeed. We'll have more people wandering by. We don't stand on ceremony here. No. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid, who has forgotten to turn down several of his electronic devices and will now do so. The list just grows longer and longer and longer. And hey, the short is out of the microphone channel tonight. What a treat! Yes. Thank you very kindly to Tom over at FYI Nation, loud and clear on FYINation.com. Thank you. Thank you, Thomas. Of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention that this is a listener-supported broadcast effort. We need to raise we need to raise $319 this evening because we pulled up short last night in fundraising. And like I said before, we really don't need to be pulling up short this week because there's a whole bunch of bills to pay this week. We have as many bills outstanding as we have anticipated revenues incoming. Mm-hmm. I already said hello, Texas T, but you gotta be on the ball here. you guys. But anyway, we need to. We've got $319 to raise this evening because we pulled up short last night. We actually pulled up $154 short, but over the course of the evening, overnight, thanks to some subscribers, and we've got a couple of new subscribers. Thank you very kindly. But over the course overnight, we've a couple of subscribers. Their kind contributions came in, which took it down to 119, which we add to 200, and carry the blast assist, and it's 319. Mm-hmm. So that's what with it. 10 at, you know what, we'll just say 10 at 31. No, let's round up. We'll round up, because after all, the Horn is the only Progressive Radio Network with a secret open carry roundup society. We'll round up, and we'll call it $320, and that means we need a 10 at 32, 32 at 10, 20 at 16, 40 at 8, 80 at 4, 100, you get the idea, yeah. But it would be good if we could, you know, check that, stop that. Yeah, take a bite out of that, okay? Oh, let's see. So much, this evening that we can deal with. There seems to be a split. There seems to be a split of opinions as to how one goes about talking about the continuing race, the race for the Democratic nomination. And we also have a note regarding Charlie in Tennessee's call last night. This is, by the way, Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, so we will be celebrating some Titanic right-wing intellect this evening, no doubt about it. But last night, Charlie called in from Tennessee, and I love our conversations, and he prompted a response from our buddy Scott in Sweden. And remember, the Beat the Swede All Year Long challenge is on. If we finish okay, if we finish fundraising where we need it to be at the end of every month, there will be an increasing contribution from our buddy Scott at the end of every month. Last January, we were okay, so that means we will, there was $50 there. If we do February 60, March 70, you see the pattern emerging. So that's on the table. And that means we've got to, well, you get the idea. But our buddy Scott says, hey, Bob or Rebob. Hey, Scott. Hey, there went the short in the microphone again. Maybe just kick it a little bit. I don't know. Scott says, Charlie was talking about large-scale pollution from electric car batteries, and you mentioned the additional problem of electrical power plants run on fossil fuels. Here's at least a little positive note from Scandinavia, where the Norwegians are going into electric cars in a big way, and Sweden is beginning to as well. Norway is mostly hydroelectricity, although Sweden uses a substantial amount of nuclear energy. At least that isn't fossil fuel. And we're working on wind predominantly, as sunlight is too seasonal here. Yeah, it's that whole, you know, near the poles thing. Our buddy Scott says, my wife and I drive a Nissan Leaf, which is not a hybrid, but a full-fledged electric car. You know, we've got a couple of Leaf drivers here in the new United States of Merca. Oh, all right. The greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, in the universe. Amen. Hallelujah. In God we trust, e pluribus unum. I got to the amen part, right? Okay. No, but okay, so we've purchased enough shares in wind-generated electricity to cover our household and transportation needs. Thus, we essentially drive on wind power, which is sun power, because we almost entirely charge at home. However, we do note that whereas last year we could not have driven too many hours outside of Stockholm without having to pick a hotel for the night because of the 8-hour recharge requirement, there have been so many new quick charge stations installed during the winter that we could now basically drive all the way to the Western Mediterranean without being forced to spend the night for recharging, provided we, you know, plan a little bit. Furthermore, Scandinavia has been a leader in recovering the materials in batteries. The chemical elements thus recovered from batteries can be reprocessed and new batteries constructed with much less damage to the environment than new batteries using chemicals entirely from mines. The idea that batteries should just be disposed of in a landfill seems totally obsolete and obscene here. Yeah, see, that's that whole civic virtue kind of thing. Yeah. You know, maybe someday it'll catch on here. Who knows? There are recycle stations everywhere in Sweden, and these include quite a number of different waste fractions, batteries being just one of those. Our local recycle station out here in the countryside has over a dozen different fraction categories. It's free to recycle, but it costs to have garbage hauled away. Don't forget to mention the upcoming end of the month Beat the Swede Challenge, which I just did, $60 this month, and that leads to either a $50 reset in March or a $70 continuation. Yes, reset if we don't make it, $70 if we do. Also, don't forget the free bumper sticker option for those signing on to monthly contributions. It's the Horny's chance to beat the Swede with a double whammy, absolutely, and that is still out there. And Agnes and I have a ton of mailing to do, without a doubt. We truly, truly do. Consequently, yes, that's out there. A pair of bumper stickers. One the horn bumper sticker, and the other being the They Want It All bumper sticker with art designed exclusively and specifically by our buddy Scott. Yes. So thank you, Scott. And yet, look, this can be done. The recycling thing, the caring about your community thing. It ain't rocket science. But then again, looking at the United States of America, one is hard-pressed not to come to the conclusion that the United States of America is not capable of rocket science anymore. Not really. Let's do remember, we don't have a manned space program anymore. Because, you know, who needs it, right? Hmm? Oh, well. So, there's that. Now, let's see. Other things. Okay, I've gone back too far in the day. And thank you, anonymous contributor, for getting us started. So we rounded up to 320, and that is now back down to 312. Thank you very kindly. So we are off and running, and we've got a start. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And I really don't want to turn this into an ongoing dialogue. I said I think about as much as I had to say about it last night. In response to Malin and Kim's kind note from up in Jersey. And then y'all had your say. But it's only fair to allow a say to those who participate via the podcast who aren't necessarily listening live in real time. So this I now do. Had a note from Jay, who's been with the program for a very, very, very long time. Who lives out in either southern Arizona or northern Mexico, depending on mood and season and whatnot. Jay offered the following. From my journal, February 22nd, I'm assuming that's 2016, because if it's 10-16, Jay, We've got more than one Third Stage Guild navigator around here. February 22nd, 2016. On tonight's Horn program, Bob addressed a letter sent to him concerning his Hillary bashing. The letter writer suggested that such actions by Bob and others could be poisoning the well should Hillary become the nominee. Bob denied that he was deliberately bashing Hillary, and besides said that he believes Sanders will be the nominee. Further, he said that if November contest really is Trump versus Clinton, that Trump would win. Bob went even further by stating that he would be willing to put money on a bet about such a contest. As Norman Goldman has pointed out to Bernie supporters, the majority of polls and political analysts disagree with that assessment. Although Bob may not be deliberately bashing Hillary, he has in fact been doing just that. He seldom makes comments that point out the qualities which make Bernie a great choice, but rather nearly always elaborates on what's wrong with Dr. Senator Secretary Hillary. I agree with Goldman that although Sanders may be a preferred choice for president, the facts are the facts. One, it is actually likely that Hillary will be the nominee, and two, running against Trump, she will easily acquire the necessary electoral college votes to win the office. There's one thing that makes this entire discussion moot as to Bob's editorializing on the Horn. The Horn's reach is quite limited, And those who are listening are made up entirely of members of the choir to which Rob Ibob is preaching. Few minds will be changed and no election results will be altered. From the land of perpetual summer, regards, Jay. And I sincerely doubt that we're going to alter the outcome of any elections. Although stranger things have happened. Nobody thought Dem Leader was gonna wind up being president either. I mean, it was so stupid. And yes, it took the Supreme Court to do it, but it only took the Supreme Court to do it because states that could reliably be counted could have been reliably counted on to deliver for the Democratic nominee, like, you know, West Virginia, didn't. And of course, I'm living proof. I live in a county that's living proof of, and a state that's living proof of what happens when people stay the hell home. I've got a religious maniac for a member of my House of Delegates who has helped to make sure that, let's see, there's no prevailing wage in this state anymore, that unions have had their throats cut in this state, that that people have a right to refuse service to other people for being gay, and that everybody can carry a concealed handgun who can muster up the strength to stuff it in their trousers, or the waistband of their trousers. So, you know, for Christ's sakes, vote. Please. Please vote. Even though, you know, y'all are the choir and I'm the preacher and no minds are going to be changed. See, that's the whole thing, though, and that's the one thing I think you missed, Jay, and that is I'm not saying anybody should change their minds. Vote as you please. I'm voting for Bernie. And in November, if Dr. Senator Secretary Clinton is the nominee, I'll vote for her. I would prefer that it not be her, because I do stand by my prediction that she'll lose to Trump. Because, see, all the things that make Democratic candidates cower and sit back in fear and say, don't say ugly things about us, Hillary and Bill. Oh, my, we'll wet ourselves. He didn't give a damn. He doesn't care, and I don't think I don't think our side's figured that out yet. Her preferred hatchet man, David Brock. He might be successful at sleazing other people. I don't think you're going to be so good at sleazing Trump, because Trump, you see, and again, our good friend Eric Bjorn brought this to the fore, Trump, it doesn't just come from reality television. Trump comes from professional wrestling, where that kind of thing is de rigueur. And, yeah, the polls may say... Well, actually, the polls don't, but that's the thing, the polls don't. The polls, I've seen at least a couple of polls that show that Hillary loses to Trump, where Bernie beats her. And so I'm left in a quandary. Jay notes that I don't spend a lot of time talking about how wonderful Bernie is. Based on the information I received from you guys, you already know how wonderful Bernie is. I saw a post on Facebook today or earlier saying, "Poor old guy, he'll just get elected and die in office. He's old as hell and he's about to croak." And you know, that's part of it. So we're going to have to work through this. We're going to have to process through this somehow. I don't know. Maybe I'll retool the program and start talking about my favorite cat pictures from the internet or something. I'm being facetious. But there, like I said, I was raised to be an FDR-style Democrat. That sort of a creature has not been very much in evidence of late, and we desperately need it. And Bernie Sanders is an FDR-style Democrat. And as to the argument being put forward by no small number of people that, well, Americans will never vote for a socialist. West Virginians will never vote for a socialist. This is something Bossman Wayne said, with which I heartily agree. He said, if every West Virginian got a check based on coal industry production the way Alaskans get a check based on oil industry production, you would have an entire state filled with socialists overnight. Hell yeah, I got my free coal check. We're gonna go out and get some new bulbs for the old lady's tanning bed, and I'm gonna get a lift kit on my four wheeler. Yeah, socialism. So I don't know what we're supposed to do. I'll have to muddle through somehow. But apparently it is, according to Jay, and again, Jay, Kim, Malin, anybody, you know, on y'all on that side of the discussion, I'm not critiquing you. And I'm not being smartass, and I'm not being sarcastic, but I'm at a loss. Do we just not talk about the stuff she does and has, oh my God, for a very long time, gotten wrong? Do we not try to, during this primary process, which this is the purpose of it, do we not try to push, not push, this would be a matter of pulling. Do we not try to just kind of drag her back from the right center, right wing, a little bit toward the political center, so that we can have some hope for the future? Yeah, I know, hope in one hand. Because I think if she's the nominee, again, if, and see the Hillary filth machine that the right wing started building in 1992, that thing's just sort of running at idle right now. It's just kind of... But if she's the nominee after the convention... they're going to take the governor off that some bitch, and it's gonna be howling on all 16 cylinders. It's a pair of twin V8s, and all the poor little Hillary people who have been so offended by the manufactured outrage of Bernie Bros are suddenly going to come face to face with a buzzsaw. And if the Bernie Bros made them cry, oh my God, I don't even want to think about what's coming at them. So I don't know. I one of these days she'll remember where West Virginia is, and then she'll say something about the coal industry here. Do I report that? Do I just kind of pretend it didn't happen? The next time there's something we want and she says, never, ever, do we just pretend that didn't happen? No, this is not necessarily a journalism outlet because everything that happens here has some degree of opinion wrapped around it because I don't play that bullshit game where we pretend at being unbiased when the entire media landscape is nothing but bias. I mean, for God's sakes, remember the millionaire David Brock, who was part of the sliming of Anita Hill and then had some sort of road to Damascus, come to Jesus moment, and then suddenly became a pro-Democrat person and set up Media Matters for America, which has done a lot of great work. Well, then he got, instead of you know, working what he'd been very good at, he got pulled into the Hillary team, where he set up that correct the record thing, and then went out and bought a house, something to turn into a house organ, a pre-existing website called Blue Nation Review. And like I said, one of Hillary's biggest donors has just bought The Onion. What? So go figure. And I'm doing it again. I'm not talking about how awesome Bernie is. I guess that's because I take the fact that Bernie's awesome, you know, for granted. Because I am a partisan. So, you know, I don't know, to this day, I don't know how limited or unlimited, well, I know it's not unlimited, our reach is. I don't know the size, the actual size of the Horn Family Commune congregation. I don't. I know we try to do this. We try to provide a forum for people to share their ideas. And most importantly, we try to make sure, I try to make sure that people are treated in like the experts in their own lives that they are. And I agree. That is extremely, extremely rare in the broadcast universe. Now, all of that having been said, we do have other stuff that does not touch upon, well, yes, it does. Everything does. Well, that's very zen of you, Heather, up in Michigan. The horn reaches who wants to reach it. Well, that's true, because nobody, you know, again, nobody gets charged for anything here. Every blessed thing that happens at the horn is free. And always has been. So the lead breaking news story coming into the top of the hour, shortly before the program began, was the letter the majority leader of the Senate of the United States got mail today. We just got a letter. We just got a letter. Wonder who it's from. Well, in this case, the letter is from Charles E. Grassley and Orrin G. Hatch. Orangey, not full orange, just orangey. Charles E. Grassley and Orrin G. Hatch and Jefferson Beauregard, Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions, the what? And Lindsey O. Graham and John Cornyn and Michael S. Lee and Ted Cruz and Jeff Flake and David Vitter and David Perdue and Thom Tillis. They was just sitting around there being senators, and they decided they'd write a letter to Mitch McConnell. Dear Mitch, I like to think of this as being read by Senator Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III. As we write, we are in the midst of a great national debate over the course our country will take in the coming years. The presidential election is well underway. Americans have already begun to cast their votes. As we mourn the tragic loss of Justice Antonin Scalia and celebrate his life's work, the American people are presented with an exceedingly rare opportunity to decide in a very real and concrete way the direction the court will take over the next generation. We believe the people should have this opportunity. Over the last few days, much has been written about the constitutional power to fill Supreme Court vacancies, a great deal of it inaccurate. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution is clear. The president may nominate judges of the Supreme Court, but the power to grant or withhold consent to such nominees rests exclusively with the United States Senate. This is not a difficult or novel constitutional question. Let's just run check real quick. And find it. Just to check in on them. I don't necessarily keep it all memorized right here in my little old punkin' head. No. Son of a bitch. And I done thought it. And he shall nominate, because this is right there from Article 2, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. He shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States of America. Okay, I added of America, because of America in there, it just says the United States. Son of a bitch. How about that? Now let's go back to that letter. The committee, they wrote me a letter. Never mind. Don't sing, Bob. The president may nominate judges of the Supreme Court, but the power to grant or withhold consent to such nominees rests exclusively with the United States Senate. Now, see, that's true. They can refuse. Who comes to mind? Bork? Abe Fortas? Hillary, what's her name? No, not that Hillary. Quit it. We're done with the Hillary part. No, George Bush's personal... No. That's how we got... Jesus, I can't remember now. Is that how we got Alito? Is that how we got Roberts? Yeah, somebody will help. But sons of bitches are lying. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution is clear. Yes, it is. That much is not a lie. But then, if we parse words, which we kind of have to do because we're dealing with liars, the president may nominate judges of the Supreme Court. True, again. But the power to grant or withhold consent to such nomination rests exclusively with the United States Senate. That ain't in Article 2, Section 2. It says advice and consent. Now, you can infer, if you wish, or you can say that it's implied if you wish, but you cannot say that that is in Article 2, Section 2, because that would be a, come on, everybody, we're talking about Republicans after all, a lie! The This is not a novel, difficult or novel constitutional question. As Minority Leader Harry Reid observed in 2005, the duties of the Senate are set forth in the U.S. Constitution. Nowhere in that document does it say the Senate has a duty to give the presidential nominees a vote. It says appointments shall be made with the advice and consent of the Senate. That is very different than saying every nominee receives a vote. Oh, those clever, crafty Republicans, turning that iron-fisted, strong-willed bastion of power, Harry Reid's words, right back upon him. Curses. We intend to exercise the constitutional power granted the Senate under Article 2, Section 2, to ensure the American people are not deprived of the opportunity to engage in a full and robust debate over the type of jurist they wish to decide some of the most critical issues of our time, at which point I will call time out and either have a conniption or make an observation. Heads. Okay, observation. It was really conniption, but I decided it was a game-time decision. And that observation is this. Whenever the Supreme Court does something that some petulant birther, deather, ninther, tenther, bircher, bagger, booger-eater, Republican, libertarian, A.N. Randian, anarcho-Randian, whatever, doesn't like, they immediately mount mount to the tops of the nearest burnt out tree stump or handy peach crate, and begin to holler about unelected black robed judges forcing their wills down our throats. Get right. So they're unelected, and yet, according to the paragraph, the portion of the paragraph that I just read to you here in my very best behind the cornpone curtain accent, suddenly the people of the new United States of Merca are going to get a say in who gets chose to be the next Supreme Court justice. Are we going to have a reality television show? I don't know. They just say we gonna get a say. But we're not. There aren't going to be any Supreme Court justices on the November ballot. Lying bastards. No, there's going to be a Republican presidential candidate on the Supreme Court ballot, on the November ballot, and there's going to be a Democratic presidential candidate on the November ballot. Yeah. I mean, there'll be some senators on there, too. And by the way, in case you're wondering, every one of the senators who signed this here little old missive, they are all just as safe as can be, and not the least little old teensy tiny itsy bitsy chance that any one of these dirty bastards would ever be thrown out of office. I think Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III, I think he's up for re-election. Well, I tell you what, with the publication of this letter, the citizens of Talabama, I'm sure, are quite up in arms. No, they're not. Bitter? No. I think Chuck Grassley is up for re-election. But then again, the last time Iowegia had a chance to go and elect a senator, they said a woman whose greatest claim to fame was her desire to cut the testes off of hogs to the Senate. So don't look for any big pressure groups, Britain. No. As Barbie says, hi, Barbie. No, Bob, these senators are rewriting history to suit their personal agendas. This is exactly what I intend to put in a letter to the very dishonorable Senator Chuck Grassley from my state. How utterly disappointing. These guys are full of shit because they have never given the public the opportunity to shape laws. By God, that's their job. Just ask. Just ask them. So anyway, we're all going to get to vote. Not since 1932 has the Senate confirmed in a presidential election year a Supreme Court nominee to a vacancy arising in that year. They finally caught up to that one. Yeah. That is some world-class bullshit hair splitting. That's what that is. Because, see, that Kennedy kid was nominated to the Supreme Court in November, December 1987. And gosh, oh golly gee, was confirmed onto the court in March, I think, maybe February of 1988, the final year of Ronald Reagan's presidency, which pretty much everybody knew, except periodically Ronald Reagan, because his brain was already, you know, liquefying. And it is necessary to go even further back to 1888 in order to find an election year nominee who was nominated and confirmed under divided government, as we have now. We down yonder in the land of cotton. Sorry, Senator Sessions just does that sometimes. Ron in the far frozen north points out, I like the part where McConnell said that Obama could have a positive impact on his legacy if he just backed off nominating a replacement judge for Big Tony. Yeah, whatever legacy he might leave would be double-tapped if he abrogated his constitutional responsibility. Well, there is that. That brief little moment actually elicited a giggle. From our buddy the Angry Indian. But see, there's a little bit of obfuscation going on here. Because, of course, it was a presidential election year when, using the recess appointment, and see, that's where the hair splitting comes in again, Eisenhower put Justice William, is it William? Yeah, Brennan Jr.? On the Supreme Court, because he just decided not to screw around with the Senate and went ahead and done it during recess. More on that in a moment. So they're picking and choosing, but well, they're Republicans, so you know they're lying. Accordingly, given the particular circumstances under which this vacancy arises, we wish to inform you, almighty Senate Majority Leader Chinless Mitch McConnell Addison, of our intention to exercise our constitutional authority to withhold any consent on any nominee to the Supreme Court submitted by this president to fill Justice Scalia's vacancy. We do. And yes, we've read your little old law review from 1970, Addison. You damn hypocrite. But y'all, you got the power, and we don't. We just going to let you know that we ain't going to hold no hearings. Because our decision is based on constitutional principle and born of a necessity to protect the will of the American people. Well, at least the American people who are sick and tired after 7 years and two long months of having that one in our White House. Old times there are Not forgotten. We're protecting the will of them people. Because the people who would like to see the Supreme Court get on with this business, including, but not limited to, retired Republican Supreme Court nominee Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, they can go and, well, we don't want to be crass, of course, here. They can go and urinate up a rope. This committee will not hold hearings on any Supreme Court nominee until after our next president, God bless you, Mr. Trump, is sworn in on January 20th, 2017. Sincerely. Yeah. Sincerely. Chuck Grassley. Orangey Hatch. Jefferson Davis, Beauregard, Sessions, the Hood. Lindsey, oh, Graham. Oh, Jeff, I just love it when you get butch like that. And your singing voice. Hold me, John. John Cornyn, Michael Leslie, Ted Cruz. Why don't you sign your real name, son? Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz. I don't know. Why would that be? Yes. How far would he have gotten in a Senate race if he would used his real name? I mean, it's not like he's Barack Obama, who's personable and charming and smart and endearing. And no. David Perdue and David Vitter and Thom Tillis. Yes. So, the Senate Judiciary Committee. Oh, wait, what? Well, I agree, but that's why we're not and he is. Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions, points out, if I was the president with that letter in hand, I'd appoint the most rabidly left-wing judge I could find. Yeah, if it wouldn't hurt the Hillary supporters' feelings too much. Sorry, says Carol, can you tell I'm pissed? Well, You and me, we, us, the Horn Family Community Congregation, we probably would nominate the most rabidly left-wing judge we could find. And that's going to be a stretch even finding them, because you don't get, I mean, I know a couple of, you know, lefty law school professors who would be great, but you don't get into the, no. But the problem is that despite all that baloney about, this has never been done before, not since 1932, back before that communist became the president. No, right? Yeah. Well, here's the problem. There is nothing in the Constitution that says the Senate has the power to do what these senators have just done. Because, see, they haven't just said they won't hold a vote. They've made something else abundantly clear. You remember a few weeks back when the members of the House, when the House leadership, the Birchers, Baggers, Deathers, Tenthers, Ninthers, Booger Eaters, etc., the toenail toothpick caucus, I like to call them. Remember when they refused to even receive President Obama's budget? Well, they've done the same thing in this regard as well. They have said not only that they will not hold a vote. See, there are There are principles, there are formalities that are observed by, or have been observed in the past by the Senate. Even if you thoroughly intend to vote against a presidential nominee to the Supreme Court. It has been a long-standing tradition, and after all, the entirety of that letter is about constitutional tradition. Yeah, give me a swig off that jug. It's been a long-standing tradition for the Senate to accord a nominee the courtesy of a meeting. Hi, how are you? Little John, Sheriff of Nottingham, Sheriff of Nottingham, Little John, S of N, LJ, LJ, S of N, Sheriff John, Nottingham, Little, right. And we meet and we greet, and now we got enough for bridge. Well, they've said they won't do that. They will not even meet with President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court. Because at this point in time, the Republicans are playing a bare-knuckled game of the rawest form of power politics. Mm-hmm. And we know that our president is far more intelligent than Addison McConnell, Chinless Mitch, on his most brilliant day. And believe me, there really aren't many brilliant days for Addison McConnell. And that speaks for the rest of that gang of little Klansmen with their goddamn robes out at the cleaners. On the Senate Judiciary Committee. But they put him in a bind. They have told the black man, don't get all uppity and be sending us a Supreme Court nominee because we're not going to do anything with him or her. Just don't do it. Because you're only three-fifths of a president. So what if you were Barack Obama? What move would you make on the 11D-dimensional chessboard? I know, I've got it. Wait until they go into recess and then do a recess appointment, just like Eisenhower did three times. Sorry. That opportunity closed yesterday. Because you see, from now until the end of the year, unless I completely miss my guess about the way that Addison McConnell operates, the Senate will not formally recess. From now until December the 31st, okay, no, from now until January 19th, some recent no seniority backbencher senator from the Republican Party will be tapped with the responsibility to stay in D.C. and walk in every morning, bang the gavel, say, we're now in session. Anyone in favor of staying in session? Hearing none. Bang the gavel. Fuck it. We're in recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And as we learned from the NLRB decision, which was not one of those 5-4 decisions, by the way, that doesn't constitute a recess. No. I don't even know what Robert's Rules of Order would call that. Taking a break? Is that a 24-hour potty break? And the next morning, the same thing, and the morning after that, and the morning after that, and the morning after that. And thanks to the NLRB decision, if I understand it correctly, Barack Obama will not be able to do a recess appointment at all. Because, well, Supreme Court said that that dog won't hunt. Now, does that mean he might try? I don't know. I don't even know the rules of 11D-dimensional chess. But I do know that with this statement, the Senate Republicans have abdicated their constitutionally sworn duties. We've been through this. They don't have to confirm the nominee. But they have to at least acknowledge the nominee. Advice and consent. And by the language of Article 2, Section 2, it's nominate and with the advice and consent appoint. So that means the nomination is the condition precedent to, with advice and consent of the Senate, appoint. That means one thing has to come before the second. And so, yes, hello, we have a constitutional crisis. Truly we do. Now, as I said, I don't know the rules of 11D-dimensional chess. But I think, and of course they've got the highfalutin lawyers there, the folks who graduated from the really expensive law schools to tell them about all this. But well, does Barack Obama say, I concede to your will, I will not nominate, and at that point in time, isn't he in violation of his constitutional oath, and does that not trigger the ability of the House to hold impeachment hearings? Or if he simply remains silent on the issue, what then? Can the House presume that he is not going to do his constitutional duty? Kind of at a loss. Hard to tell. But this is a real, live, no kidding, constitutional crisis. And it is also, in my estimation, an absolute abrogation of constitutional duty. And in point of fact, an act of revolution and insurgency on the part of the Republican majority in the Senate of the United States and those who support them. It appears that for those of you listening live and the podcast, I mean, this is a podcast at this point in time, it appears that the stream has gone sideways. So it just so happens that it's the top of the hour and we can close out the filibobster and take a break. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is the Horn. Green News Report on the way. We'll be right back with, what was that? Yeah, $312 to raise to stay to get out of the hole. Nope, wrong song. Nope, wrong song. Oh, what the heck. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Oh,
It's Tuesday, February 23, 2016.
The ground keeps shaking in Oklahoma, and more violently.
Oklahoma finally acts to reduce man-made fracking earthquakes.
We will not extract fossil fuels in the future from any public lands.
Bernie Sanders promises to end drilling on federal property. Hillary Clinton promises to end drilling off the Atlantic coast. A slap on the wrist for the CEO behind West Virginia's toxic chemical spill. Plus,
cleanup is underway after one of the most powerful storms on record tore through Fiji.
Tropical cyclone Winston smashes the record for the strongest hurricane ever in the Southern Hemisphere.
All of those records and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
An exact replica of the Titanic will set sail in 2018, and this time it should be perfectly safe, because by then, we should be out of icebergs.
And that would be funnier if it weren't quite as true. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, the average number of earthquakes in Oklahoma is now 2.5 per day. It used to be 1.5 per year.
Yep, and now Oklahoma is the earthquake capital of the United States, surpassing even California. The earthquakes have been linked by the U.S. Geological Survey to the fracking industry's use of deep underground wells to dispose of toxic fracking wastewater. Oklahoma residents have now filed class action lawsuits against those fracking companies, seeking damages because they say it's now impacting their property values.
You have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of real estate that's being damaged by that activity.
And now, after years of denying the link between fracking and earthquakes, now the state of Oklahoma is finally taking action. Sort of. Regulators have ordered operators of only 250 injection wells to limit the depth and the volume of the toxic fracking wastewater that they inject deep underground by a whopping 40%.
So wait, so they put this wastewater into the ground, that makes the rocks slippery, causes earthquakes. Are they suggesting that if you put less water in
and less deeply, then it'll back off those earthquakes a little bit?
Yeah, well, good luck with that.
In the battle for the Democratic Party presidential nomination, both candidates are pushing hard to further restrict fossil fuel extraction on public lands and territories. At the most recent Democratic town hall hosted by MSNBC, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont pledged to end all oil and gas exploration on lands owned by taxpayers. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hasn't gone so far as to promise to end fossil fuel drilling on public lands, but she has now come out against offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast. Now, she had already pledged to end drilling in the Arctic, and Clinton has been slow to catch up to Senator Sanders' push for policies that keep fossil fuels in the ground. But she's trying to make up the difference in some fashion.
Amazing how just a few years ago, the Republican motto was drill, baby, drill. And now you've got Democrats out there saying, no, no more drilling wherever we can stop it. And they're doing it proudly and don't seem to be taking much blowback for it. Good for them.
On the Republican side of the presidential race, Ohio Governor John Kasich may have been trying to distinguish himself from the remaining Republican candidates when at a Vermont town hall over the weekend, he said he accepts that humans have some effect on the climate.
I do not know how much that individuals affect the climate, but here's what I do know. I know that we need to develop all of the renewables, and we need to do it in an orderly way, and we need to have wind, and we need to have solar.
So he's not an out-and-out denier? Maybe that's progress on the Republican side?
Nah, it's a line that the remaining Republicans have been trying out. They've been supporting wind and solar, but they don't support any curbs on fossil fuels or greenhouse gas emissions. Those are what actually cause climate change. Meanwhile, record warm oceans turbocharged a record hurricane season in 2015, and the record-breaking continues in 2016. Tropical cyclone Winston made landfall in the island nation of Fiji as a Category 5 storm over the weekend, killing at least 28 people and causing widespread destruction. Tropical cyclone Winston broke the record for the strongest cyclone ever recorded in the Southern Hemisphere. That's just 4 months after Hurricane Patricia broke the record for the strongest storm ever recorded anywhere on the planet. Finally, remember the West Virginia chemical spill when toxic coal waste from a decrepit storage tank farm contaminated the drinking water supply of 300,000 people back in 2014?
I do. Freedom Industries, they called themselves.
Yep. The former president of Freedom Industries was also charged with negligence, bankruptcy fraud, and perjury for lying to investigators in a scheme to protect his personal fortune from liability after the disaster. Well, he's been sentenced. The millionaire CEO was sentenced to 1 month in prison and a fine of $20,000, the absolute minimum sentence allowed.
Unbelievable. Well, I guess if he's sentenced to even 1 month at this point, we should be happy there's any accountability for these guys whatsoever. Amazing. For much more on those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Minutes past the hour, and hey, look, I think we're broadcasting live some more. Yay. Yeah. I took the break there to get in touch with Ben Birch, and he reset the servers and did the magic that only he can do. And so through the miracle of the interweb tubes, you know, it's not a big truck. We are broadcasting again. You'll just have to check out for however much of the program we missed. I didn't know until I started seeing notifications pop up out of the corner of my eye going, yeah, you ain't on the air. I don't know how much we missed or you missed. I was here for it. But you can catch it on the podcast if you really want it. But so that. All right. Hour two. And yes, do let's remember that we are in a $312 hole and need to get out of it so as to pay bills, so as to keep this little independent broadcasting operation going. Okay? The interface, PayPal, headonradionetwork.com/contribute, yeah? And, hey, I didn't give out the mailing address, did I? Well, of course, it is, as it has been for, yay, these many years, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV, 25801. And we recommend checks and money orders made payable to The Horn. Not Bob Kincaid, and not cash. We love cash. If you must send cash, cash will do. But there's a pilferage problem that we have personal experience of inside the United States Postal Service. I know, don't bash the Postal Service, Bob, but it's real. So, there you go. Where next? Oh, okay, this kind of works. Yeah, this works real well in terms of, you know, sort of transitions and continuity. I presume you have, I don't know, maybe you haven't. So in the previous hour, we were talking about the fact that the Senate of the United States, the Republican majority of the Senate of the United States, has done something that No other Senate Judiciary Committee has ever done before. And that is effectively tell a sitting president of the United States that he shall not exercise the constitutional powers with which he is vested. Let me repeat. Every sitting white president of the United States has had the power and has, in fact, appointed Supreme Court justices, even in election years. John Adams comes to mind. Just saying. Every white president has had that power. But we finally got one who is, you know, blah. He doesn't get that power. Because, you know, blah. And he may be blah, Barack Obama. But he's not blah enough. Just ask mumbling Ben Carson, who is still, for reasons passing understanding, campaigning for the presidency. Somebody's told him it's going to be good for the book deal. Most recently, because, you know, anything for a story, I guess, Mumblin' Ben sat down for an interview with that bastion of journalism, Politico. Well, I mean, it's a Politico podcast called Off Message. Oh my, that's clever. And by God, he delivered, Mumblin' Ben did. Somewhere along the way, the question turned to one of Barack Obama. And from Mumblin' Ben Carson, we learned, no, really. That Barack Obama isn't black enough. Speaking of the President of the United States, Mumblin' Ben said, although they had to really crank the gain up on his RE20, he's an African-American. He was, raised white. I mean, like most Americans, I was proud that we broke the color barrier when he was elected. But he didn't grow up like I grew up. Many of his formative years were spent in Indonesia. So for him to, claim that, he identifies with the experience of black Americans, I think is a bit of a stretch. And remember now, I've been around for 64 years, I've had a chance to see what real racism is. So then they asked him the real Lulu question. Well, what about being a black guy in the Republican Party? I mean, the Republican Party is about 90% white. The other 10% aren't black. 2 out of the other 10% are black. And he said, I don't find any particular problem being an African-American in the Republican Party. Maybe I'm just very non-observant. I don't go around looking for things. And you have to understand that whatever you think is going on is probably what you're going to see. So if somebody told you that you're about to meet somebody and they're really a mass murderer and they're just looking for an opportunity to kill you, everything they say, you're going to say, uh-huh, see what he's trying to do. Whereas if they told you the very same person really loves everybody and is looking for a way to enhance them in the very same thing, you say, oh, wow, yeah. That's really good. So, in short, we can, until such time as he chooses to drop out of the race, which means when the money runs dry, we have a man who has admitted to a Washington-based publication in audio podcast form that he just believes anything anybody tells him, and that a serial killer and a really loving person, a person who really loves everybody, well, they sound about the same to him, mumbling Ben Carson. But, man, if you're Barack Obama, you feel kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't you? I mean, on the one hand, he's being stymied in his attempt to be president by a group of old white men who think he's just too damn black to be appointing any Supreme Court justices. On the other, famed neurosurgeon Ben Carson says he's not black enough. Anybody, this would probably be best coming from a member of the Horn Family Community Congregation who comes from a community of color. Anybody want to help here? How does one be black enough to suit mumbling Ben Carson? Because I'm at a loss. Compare this, if you will, because I just see these things. I notice things. Maybe I'm what mumbling Ben's talking about, and I look for it because it's usually out there. I ran across an excerpt of some news story that was not properly attributed, so I can't tell you where to go and find it. But it was a news story about, and I presume it was out of South Carolina, although that is a presumption on the part, because, again, the story was merely excerpted and not properly attributed. But it was a story about Bernie Sanders addressing a black church at their, I guess, in their fellowship hall. And the thrust of the article was to create the impression that, well, that Bernie Sanders, he just doesn't resonate with black people. Because that's a big meme that's out there that no doubt is generated, you know, out of the Clinton camp. You know, just like the whole Bernie Bros kerfuffle was. And so it was, you know, it was your typical campaign writing kind of thing. Where it gave some, some atmospherics. And it described the church, and it described the people, and it talked about how Bernie, standing next to the buffet line, launched into one of his stump speeches, and he got to the part about the judicial system and racial inequality, and then the author of the piece, whom I don't know, because, again, the story was not properly attributed, then said, and when he got to this line, the older black people in the audience didn't clap much, They just kept eating their lunch on a line that usually brings roars of approval when Bernie is talking to those college kids. But in the middle of all of this was the statement, you know, Bernie Sanders today at the Praise Jesus Holiness Church, yada yada, spoke to a group of African-American adults who seemed to not be quite so as interested in him as they were in their lunch. He spoke next to the luncheon buffet, which consisted of fried chicken, collard greens, and fresh-baked rolls. Granted, it was toward the end of the evening last night, but I read that, and just because I often use her as sort of a sounding board, a barometer, if you will. I said to Agnes, I read the passage to her, and I said, why the hell did the journalist feel the need to tell us what was on the menu, what the dinner fare was? And I still don't have an answer. Because if it had been Bernie speaking to a group of white people, the question obtains, would the reporter have said, and they were tucking into a meal of free-range, gently killed quail, quinoa, and artisanal sourdough bread? Because I don't think the journalist would have done that, journalist. Was it a matter of, damn, that was some mighty fine fried chicken and collards? Should I just be glad that they didn't add anything else to the list? Yeah, I'm sensitive to these things. But I'm also a pasty-faced, doughy white guy, and I may be oversensitive. You tell me. I don't know. Jim says regarding mumbling Ben Carson, can you not see his strategy by holding on in the eventual outcome? No, because he finished 6th out of 6 and has never gotten closer than 4th. But Jim goes on and says, your Carson accent does not work, period. Well, it's not an accent, it's an impression, Jim. And I didn't say it was a good one. Just trying to approximate the sort of stumbly, mumbly cadence of his speech. You know, where he talks a lot like this. Like he's about to sort of fall asleep in the middle of whatever he's going to say. That may be Ron. Ron says, I don't think that piece was written by a journalist, but by a blogger. You went there, Carol Baker. Mumbling Ben is claiming, as Carol notes, that because Obama was raised white, he didn't really experience racism. Republicans are sure making up for lost time. Amen. And you know, maybe there may be a soupçon, a scintilla of truth in what Mumbling Ben says. Barack Obama did not experience the overt systemic cultural racism he would have experienced had he grown up in South Carolina or Alabama or Mississippi Stan. Maybe that's why his mama got him right the hell out of the United States as quick as she could, because she loved her son. And she didn't ever want him to know that most vile and base of American character traits. You know what? He probably didn't experience racism in Indonesia. You know, when he was going to that Muslim madrasa. It might be worth remembering that, because the right wing says he's a secret Muslim, and my own member of the House of Delegates says he makes secret Muslim-y hand signs, and he's got this ring, see? And is it not true that when Malcolm X, after his conversion, and after he went on his Hajj, his pilgrimage to Mecca, was that not a turning point for him when he looked around and realized there was every color of Muslim on earth? He saw white Muslims, brown Muslims, Asian Muslims, Muslims of every hue, and he realized that, you know, it's a belief system and not an ethnic monolith. Maybe Barack Obama's mama. Maybe she realized that her son, whom she dearly loved, would have a better chance in life if she just got him the hell out of the land of his birth and let him experience the wider world. That maybe seeing that wider world would provide him with a better perspective on said world. But I don't think you have to have, and this by no means is an attempt on my part to discount the experience of it, but I don't think you have to have your church blown up. I don't think you have to be going to a church where white people blow up your house of worship, or I don't think you have to be trying to peaceably assemble in an American city and have white people turn dogs and fire hoses on you to understand what a brutal problem racism is in this country. Because it remains a brutal problem. And if nothing else be said, and many things will, but if nothing else be said of the Barack Obama presidency, let it be said that his 8 years in office taught us that racism is anything but over in this country. Take, for instance, I mean, this is a real gut bender. Naturally, the story comes from Texas. Naturally, it's the story of a couple of white boys, Tucker Sauer, S-A-U-E-R, and Lucas Henderson, down in Austin, Texas. There was one more. It happened over the weekend. where the three young men were in an apartment building and standing on a balcony when they saw a black guy walking on the street below them. KXAN News has the story. As he walked past on the sidewalk below, the three began to throw bottles at him, and they narrowly missed his head. As they threw the bottles, they screamed, "Fuck you, nigger." When the man said, "All right, I'm calling the police," the two young white assholes came roaring down the stairs to have a fight. Twenty-one-year-old Tucker Sauer and 20-year-old Lucas Henderson were taken into custody. But they wouldn't give up the full name of the third guy. They just called him Danny. Well, Danny wouldn't answer his phone or open his door, asking them why they did it. They said, "Oh, we've been partying all day." But yes, all three did chase their victim down the street. The University of Texas has yet to confirm whether the three racists, well-meaning boys engaging in youthful hijinks are members of the University of Texas student body, who, by the way, just as a gentle reminder, can now carry concealed weapons to class if they so choose. Merca. Wolverines! See, you don't have to directly experience that to be disgusted by it. And you know what? Even if you didn't grow up here, you can be sickened by it. And you know what? If you didn't grow up here, it's possible that you might be made more sick by it. But hey, let's not go just beating on Texas like Texas is some sort of special place where this is the only place where this kind of thing happens. Well, hell no. And by the way, back to Ben Carson for a moment. Ron points out, one could suggest that the reason Ben is not doing well in the actual primary voting, policies notwithstanding, is exactly the same reason Republicans don't like that one. He's a person of color in a party that is less than 10% non-white. Ignoring all the other dipshit factors, I don't think Piyush Jindal would have fared very well for much the same reason. If either or both of these candidates had any reasonable ideas that would otherwise have appealed to those middle-of-the-road Republicans, they still would have failed. But no, let's not just go hammering along on poor old Texas. Let's hammer on Missouri. Hi, Carol. Mm-hmm. According to KMOV news. A Muslim family moved from Jerusalem to St. Louis because, and this is ironic, because St. Louis is safer than Jerusalem if you're a Muslim. Daddy's from Jerusalem. His wife is from Iraq. And they've got four kids. And they wanted to, you know, not have them die. So they moved to St. Louis. And they were house hunting. And they found a little cottage on the corner of Sioux Drive and Big Chief Drive. No kidding. Because, you know, Merca. Carol says, hammer away. I won't get all butthurt about it. So somewhere in St. Louis, there's a little house for sale on the corner of Sioux Drive and Big Chief Drive. You know, just around the corner from Cherokee Street and a block down from Navajo Circle. Huh. So having looked at the house, they went to leave. That's where they met 72-year-old Leonardo DiBello. And, of course, everyone knows that Leonardo DiBello is an old Apache name. Only it's not. And upon seeing them, 72-year-old Leonardo DiBello allegedly shouted, "You Muslim? You should die. This state allows you to carry a gun and shoot you." At which point, he went back inside his house there on either Sioux Drive or Big Chief Drive and came back out with a freedom protector. By then, Mr. and Mrs. really didn't want our children to die in the Middle East, have gotten their kids into the car, themselves into the car, and 72-year-old Leonardo DiBello points the gun at the car and said, "You, your wife, and your kids have to die." Now, when KMOV reached out to him, because it's not like life's going to get particularly difficult for 72-year-old Leonardo DiBello. When KMOV tried to interview him, he said, "I'm a decorated Vietnam veteran. And I've got post-traumatic stress disorder. And see, look here, I hung a sign inside my house on my door. It said, 'Take your meds.'" Because he wasn't taking his meds when he screamed at the Muslim family, turned around, went back in the house, got his Second Amendment remedy, came back out of the house, and pointed his Second Amendment remedy at four children and told them they have to die. Merca. Hot damn. Hey, let's run over to the phones. Wait, before the phones, I'm going right there. But in light of our $312 hole in the budget, a note coming in from our buddy Thomas Subject line, have a match, start a fire, $100, I will match up to the next $100, penny for penny. He's not encouraging you to send it in one penny at a time. But if Thomas's challenge is met, that will take us down to being only $120 away from getting out of the hole, which would be helpful in the extreme. And we got about an hour and 15 minutes to do it in. Yeah, right, exactly. My thoughts exactly, Steve in New York. Subject line, PTSD. Because of all the Muslims he fought in Vietnam? You know, Charlie's Charlie, right? Cindy in the Great Northwest merely refers to Mumbling Ben as Stumbling Bum Carson, the guy who lost his license to practice by killing too many patients, king of medical malpractice losses, or near to. I think he huffs that stuff from the surgery department they use to relax people before the gas kicks in. I don't know. Is there a story out there? Did he actually lose his license? I'm not familiar with it if he did. Let's see. Let's go to the phones now. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you, John. What's up?
Oh, I just thought I'd remark on a few things you've spoken about, not spoken about, all that good stuff. Haven't talked to you in a while, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, listened to a rather interesting article today that I found almost saddening to the point of crying and doing seppuku. They broke down the money that was spent for each vote for the, I believe it was for the South Carolina.
So that would be Republicans.
Well, no, well, yeah,
because they haven't had the Democratic primary in South Carolina yet. That's Saturday.
Right. Well, blessed be Almighty Trump, spent a grand whopping $64 per vote that he received. Great. And they went through the rack and they said, you know, Cruz spent like 77 and I don't remember the exact numbers, but the one that caught me, and you just happened to bring his name up just before you answered the phone there. When I heard this number, I started to cry. Ben Carson, for all the small amount of people that he got, he spent a whopping $713 for each vote that he received in that state.
God, I wonder how much Jebbia spent.
I think Jebbia was running
about out in Iowa. Didn't that one delegate cost him $20 million?
Something like that. But if I'm not mistaken, I might be off on the numbers. Carol, with her instant access to the mighty planetary brain, could probably confirm it. But I think Jebbia was something like $123 a hit for each vote that he got. And it was like, I mean, you know, and what's really funny, they talked about it a lot today. They were, you know, there's a meme starting to pop out there that maybe Citizens United isn't quite such a bad thing because look at all the money Jeb Bush spent. And he didn't go anywhere. Okay, well, that's...
Well, hey, Carol points out that works out to 13 cents a lie.
That's right. Rack up, break the piggy bank, rack it up. But, I, you know, as you probably can tell from my phone number, I quasi live in Nevada. And, I've got several friends out there. And, I don't know if you talked about this, last night or whatever, but, a not so much spoken about, but old Mr. Harry Reid was really pounding the phones and pavement caucus night for Hillary. I mean, he was in conference calls with Culinary Union, and he was just pushing every button there was on her behalf. So you could tell where he was going with that. But the establishment, both on the Republican and Democratic side, the establishment is in some ways getting a little bit scared. you know, they're worried that Bernie's going to have leverage at the convention. And on the Republican side, the Republicans are in a quiet, absolute wrist-slitting fear right now. I mean, everybody is pulling every stop there is to try to boost up Rubio to try to take down Trump. I mean, they're pulling every stop there.
Yeah, I don't see that happening, John.
I don't see it actually happening, but I do, like I said, my contacts and stuff like that, they're telling me that the phones are just ringing off the hook. They made an announcement over the weekend that Willard Romney had supported Rubio, but it turned out to be a false one. And they're trying to get him to come out. But I believe it was this evening or yesterday evening, trying to get him to commit to supporting Rubio because of the strong Mormon vote in Nevada, hoping that that would swing it tonight for him.
Well, he was a Mormon for a while, little Marco was.
Yeah, so they're trying to, you know, like I said, I don't know how it's going to fly or not. I don't know if it will or not, but my old friends and stuff are telling me that this is just turning into the establishment is losing their freaking minds, because as far as the math goes, as far as, the polling and what have you, as far as the math goes, there are people now saying that Trump's already got it pretty well sewn up for their side of the fence.
It's hard to see where he doesn't. I mean, the thing is, John, we're talking about the Republican Party here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is possible. I think it's entirely possible that, maybe the conventional wisdom is right on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe once we've gotten past the really, really, really white states of Iowa and New Hampshire, and Nevada was close, but the difference was made, for all I know, by the push polling that did, and I don't know if you got one of those calls, but I probably operate with a cell phone, so you probably didn't get no. But anyway, that when we get into more diverse populations, that for some reason or another, the idea of income inequality will suddenly cease to matter, and that freaking baffles me. But maybe they're right. But see, the I mention that because there is nowhere in this country where the Republicans aren't just absolutely crazier than a sprayed roach, John.
Oh yeah,
like the primary is going to move on to that bastion of sanity, Talibandiana, or that majestic monument to moral rectitude, Missouri or Texas. There's nowhere in the country that the Republican Party is not a vicious, hate-filled, racist rump of the party that once gave us Eisenhower. That party's over. That horse is gone. The barn's burnt down. This is the party that Ronald Reagan helped create.
I'm in Texas right now. I'm overnighting at one of the fancy new truck stops down here, and I just came in for a little while ago from the restaurant, and I'm hearing it. I mean, I hear it on the ground level. Now, granted, the type of people I generally end up bumping into tend, by the nature of their profession, tend to be a little bit on the wacko side, but it's pretty much constant out there. I mean, And if you filter through, some of the spleen that's going on out there, these people, Trump's positions, his quote unquote policy positions, are nebulous at best. You can't get five people lined up in a row who can say what his positions are on anything.
Well, it's because he's never held an elected office. He's never had to formally commit to anything.
Right. But the one thing that they are all absolutely united, and they even did a couple polls here over this last weekend, the most popular, I think it's up in the 70 percentile range within the Republican quote-unquote party, the thing that they all love the most is his position on moratorium against Muslim immigration. They have wrapped themselves around that. That and the wall around, you know, we're down there making a wall down around Texas. It seems to be those are the things that have crystallized in the minds of the people I run into, you know. And like I said, I'm in Texas right now. And you would think, from the way that these people talk down here, that there is a great brown horde on the other side of the Rio Grande River that is going to charge across the river and take over the country. Now, my accent sucks, but you get the idea. These people, this is a military mindset. These people think they're at war, that their way of life is disappearing. I have heard this now, especially in this last couple of weeks. I hear all the time, we're not even allowed to discipline our children anymore because the government going to come in and tell us I can't spank my child. I said, well, what do you spank them with? Well, I use a switch I take out of the backyard off a switch. Uh-huh. Okay, we see where that's coming from. And yet these people think that they're totally, it's that old, and I hate to use the term because I can't figure out one that's better, but it's this old rural mindset that somehow they are the special people and that they're the true Americans. Anyone who ain't like them is not a true American. They are liberals and foreigners.
If you didn't have a good beating or two coming up, you can't hardly expect to be a good American.
That's right.
You might find this interesting. I had occasion, because I'm just that weird, I read an excerpt of the closing argument made by Clarence Darrow in the Leopold and Loeb trial of many, many, many years ago. And in it, he questions how it was, because that was the crime of the century. It was the second crime of the century of the 20th century. And he questions how on earth something as horrific as the murder that case was about could have happened. And he said, I don't know, paraphrasing. But I can tell you that when a country sends thousands and thousands and thousands of its young men off to fight a brutal war, and they then come home, we see an uptick in the violence. This would be echoed to a certain extent years later by Dr. King. When he said, you know, by Gandhi, who said violence begets violence. And I happen to think that's absolutely true.
Well, it is.
And I remember a conversation I overheard in the Atlanta airport one evening. I was waiting on a flight to come back to West Virginia. And there was some story on the TV there in the concourse. In the waiting area at the desk, ticketing, whatever. At the gate, that's the word I'm looking for. Where the TV story, the CNN story, was about somebody getting in trouble for beating the living daylights out of their child. And all the middle-aged people sitting around just sort of shook their heads. And eventually one of them said, well, all I know is I got a few good whoopings from my daddy. And you know what? I turned out all right. And I whooped my youngins too. And I'm just kind of keeping my distance thinking, yeah, you know, remind me not to. Right.
you know, that's how this crap works. I mean, these people, I sometimes, in tongue in cheek, I think of it like it's the dream of being the Mad Max world or something. That they're not happy, you know, this world just isn't happy for them because there's no gladiatorial games and you're not feeding Christians to the lions or whichever religious group you want to feed to, you know, lions. You know, they do. They dream this stuff up, and it's just sometimes I sit back and, you know, again, the environment I hang out in tends to be somewhat restrictive, but sometimes, you know, because, you know, truck stops in many cases are quite popular with locals. You sit down on like a Sunday afternoon after church or something like that, and the words start flying around. It's like, you don't even have to say a word. It's like an amazing education. I mean, you go in there and it's, you know, I had a situation earlier this last weekend. I was down. I've kind of been hanging around Texas for the last week or so, running stuff back and forth. And so, between Texas, Louisiana, et cetera. And I was in a restaurant and, you know, the restaurant had a sign on the door, you know, please don't bring your guns. And here come, you know, Sunday after church dinners and stuff, and sitting down there, and here come three. And of course, they're all wearing the forest camo, you know, like they just came out of the freaking, you know, like out hunting orcs or something. They come out wearing their, you know, their camo fledged stuff and strapping. And it's like, you know, and here come the little owner and the poor fellow. Oh, I felt my heart went out to him. He was a little Indian fellow. So, little tiny guy, he comes up, please, sir, please, no, we do not want the guns in our place. And you say you do it yourself with your little voice and stuff, but it was straight out of that. This is goddamn America. We are believing in the freedom of the Second Amendment, and no little peck-soon son of a bitch gonna tell me no. And heads all went. And everybody's like, it's like everybody stopped for a second. It was like they were waiting for the, okay, which way is the coin going to go? It's rolling. It's spinning. Okay, sir. And everybody's like, whew. And they went and sat down, had their breakfast, but they got their way. As long as they get their way, they're happy. But you stand in front of them and you tell them no, they're going to have a God bloody damn shit fit because they think the goddamn world was made for them. You know, see yeah, their names
they're
right
there. They're very, very dangerous, spoiled babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, spoiled babies with, you know, 357 rattles.
Yeah, well, that too. John, yeah, good to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Oh, no trouble at all.
Those little slices of Americana, at some point in time, this whole country is going to qualify as performance art.
Yeah. I can see it one day pull into a truck stop and at the corner of each corner of the building there's going to be a guy with a 50 caliber standing there. Anyway, yeah. Catch you later.
All right, take care, John. Bye now. Our buddy John from Texas, where apparently Sunday dinner at the truck stop is downright interesting. I remember once upon a time Sunday, you know, well, not even Sunday, but 2 a.m. study break in college at a little truck stop at the Kingdom City exit of I-70 called Gaspers, and we went there at 2 because that's when the biscuits started coming out of the ovens, and that's when the sausage gravy was the freshest, and of course that was a different America. Ronald Reagan was just getting his hooks into the country, and I don't even remember seeing anybody carrying a gun in there that wasn't a cop, but different America. Note from Ron in the frozen north regarding Mr. Leonardo DiBello of St. Louis, Missouri. Whatever lingering PTSD effects resulting from my 4 tours in Vietnam make me want to nail this bigoted old dude right in the boys with a 2x4. I personally know some old white guys that absolutely hate Obama, Muslims, Chinese, welfare, and atheists. I'm familiar with all the usual reasons for such reactions, but deep down, I think these old white people, men and women, are deeply afraid that they're losing an America that never existed. I think we're going to have to invent another award. That's the philosophy toaster for the evening. Yes. Well, it was an America that existed for them, Ron. That existed for them as long as, you know, they... as long as no one troubled them in their bigotries, in their hatreds, and in whatever passed for, you know, their community and their loving kindness and their version of Jesus, all was well. But they're not particularly well suited to change. Just not. And what I expected Ron to say was that when you got down to it, they probably hated all those people long before they ever went to Vietnam. And if you disagree, tell me so, Ron, but I think that's true. Because PTSD won't make you a bigot. PTSD will not make you a racist, if I understand the diagnosis correctly. Not to draw on a direct analogy, but, you know, falling off the wagon did not cause, in terms of direct and proximate cause, falling off the wagon did not cause Mel Gibson to stand on the high on the side of the 405 or the 5 or the 1 or the 6 and 7 8 somewhere in L.A., having been busted for DUI, screaming about the Jews. That was there before he ever fell off the wagon. That was in the wagon with him. So, thank you for the philosophy. You get the philosophy toaster tonight, Ron. And let's run over and talk to Will in Chicago. Hey, Will.
Hey, Bob. How do I sound?
You sound dandy.
Good, good. I was going, ironically, when you were heading that way, I was going to bring up Mel Gibson and also point out it also did it. PTSD or alcohol did not also make him make rather sexist remarks about the breasts of a female officer on the scene as well. I mean, let's be blunt. There are some people who can't stand others like them, and also people who misinterpret things because they don't have the context. I once knew an archaeologist who was visiting the University of Chicago. He mentioned a few things. One, spoil the rod, spare the child. No veteran in his right mind would use a rod to hit a sheep. Rather, it's to nudge and to guide. So he also said, by the way, any veteran who would actually camp out around Bethlehem around December 25th would probably be looked at as having completely lost it by his neighbors, but sadly,
not exactly a tropical paradise.
Not exactly a tropical paradise that time of year. I mean, it's a bit above the level of Tel Aviv, which is a lot warmer, as I understand. But I mean, here's the thing: we have in too many people in our country a sense of entitlement, that they don't have to pay for anything, and if you're not doing well, surely it must be heaven's fault. I mean, good. The problem with this bootstrap philosophy is I've been at schools in Chicago and Gary where the kids damn lucky to afford winter coats. And it takes money that their parents often don't have, just like it takes money to keep a show like The Horn or Mike Malloy or Nicole Sandler going. And, I mean, the problem with the Republican mindset I'm seeing out there is a sense of anger, a sense of rage, a sense that history is turning against them. Well, I look at it this way. I appreciate the diversity of my country and my neighbors. I actually enjoy Middle Eastern food, although in one place locally, which apparently was not by the wait staff, didn't seem all that authentic. Wait was so bad, I wrote the person who served me a note that after an hour of waiting, I will conclude that I have had better service at White Castle and from vending machines.
Oh, that's cold. That's
yeah.
Cold. Hey,
yeah.
Hey, you know what? Cultures do change, though. Can I just give you a little moment, Will? I walked in. There's a chain of convenience stores that has expanded into West Virginia, out of Pennsylvania, called Sheetz, Sheetz. And they're really pretty nice. You know, they've made a real effort to have a nice coffee bar in there, and they can microwave you or deep fry you some food, and you know, you won't hate yourself too much. But I walked in, and lo and behold, in Fayette County, West by God, Virginia, Will, I saw a big sign, like on a sandwich board, that said, "We now have falafel."
Good heavens, if I hadn't actually known a woman who is Jewish and grew up in West Virginia, I would have to consult clergy to see if that was a miracle. But, I mean, cultures do change.
Oh, yeah, no, and I was like, really? Falafel? Damn, give me two. And you know, they're in the cold case.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know if there's a, I don't know if there's a corresponding the metaphor for, you know, for something being of less than the stunning gravity. Well, that's just a bowl of cold falafel, but but it's in the cold case. But it's in the cold case because it comes with a self-contained little cup of tzatziki.
That definitely sounds a bit better than some of my road options while traveling through different parts of the country.
So I paid up so as not to be arrested, and hide myself hence over to the microwave. Took the little tzatziki cup out, got one of the little paper containers they put the fried macaroni and cheese triangles in. Yes, they serve those, and popped it in the microwave, nuked my falafel, and felt like I was having some sort of hillbilly epiphany.
Well, there is growth and change, and this is why I have hope for this country and this world and this benighted species we call humanity, which too often doesn't act humane. I mean, I've been paying close attention to the primary and caucuses results, and I would argue for the Democrats, it's far over from over, because last time Hillary Clinton did try to argue against President Obama that, well, I have all the superdelegates. Well, guess what? The superdelegates eventually will go to the winner for two reasons. One, they don't want to annoy their voters. Two, they need to curry favor. So I would suggest to the Bernie supporters, don't lose hope. The path to victory may be uphill, no pun intended, but it is still there. And regardless, we are seeing, as Paul Waldman stated, the Overton window being moved a little further to the left than it has been.
Well, that's true.
In
I mean,
35
I did,
years.
I did see the other day that, and. It was just a blow by for me, but I saw some mention that now Dr. Senator Secretary Clinton is out there saying that maybe possibly kind of sort of we might on a day that, you know, doesn't have an R in it, have a public option?
Yes, simply because she is feeling the pressure. Politicians respond to money. And by the way, the Horn could use some more money tonight. And pressure. So if Hillary Clinton does become the nominee, my fellow progressives, keep the pressure up on her. Vote for as many progressive candidates as you can for other offices. And possibly there can be a counterweight to Wall Street money. I'm sorry, when Hillary Clinton has said that the money she's received from Wall Street doesn't influence her, I have to take that about as being as likely as the truthfulness of a caller to a late-night talk show saying he witnessed a menage a trois between Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, a Sasquatch aboard a UFO whose gray alien commander was wearing a Mickey Mouse hat, smoking a hookah, and breakdancing at the same time.
Well, amen. You know, dear penthouse, I never thought this would happen to me.
To me, yes. Although one would hope that a Sasquatch would have better taste in lovers than Bill O'Reilly and Ann Coulter.
Well, but you know, you say that the race is long and the race is maybe uphill, but there's a coattail effect out there.
Yes,
there are down ballot people who candidates who are running, saying, you know, I'm a Bernie guy, vote for me.
Right,
and apparently it's doing well for them, but it happens on both sides of the ticket. And you reminded me of something. I was in a local establishment earlier today, and I have no idea who this guy is, but there was a little business card sitting on the counter of the business, and it's a white business card, and then the letters at the top are sort of tannish, greenish tan, and naturally they spell out the last name in all caps, Brown, and then there's a blue underline, and then blue capital letters, vote Thomas T.B. Brown. You know, maybe I don't know. I don't think I'd want people to remember it. Oh yeah, him. Yeah, Tuberculosis Brown. Fayette County Board of Education. And okay, so that's standard, except for the TB part. Man, if we were going to break next, I'd queue up. I think I'd queue up TB sheets, but never mind. Then comes his campaign slogan. Care to guess?
No, but I hope it's not. I'm slightly better than Typhoid Mary.
Well, you could make an argument that that's the philosophical upshot of this. Make our schools, because remember, he's Fayette County Board of Education candidate.
Yes.
Make our schools great again.
Please. My reaction to Donald Trump is that his political statements and lack of policies remind me of something I read, which stated the truth about whale urine. Not much to it, and very diffuse. And here's the problem.
We're going to be passing out.
The Anti-Defamation League will likely complain at the end of the program. But Trump is going to have coattails on the GOP side. I think Bernie will, but I don't think Hillary will have very long coattails because she is a known commodity of whom a lot of questions can be raised. And if the FBI investigation into her emails continues into November, expect the likely Republican nominee Donald Trump to mention that every 3 to 5 minutes.
Seconds.
Well, he has, Bob, you have to allow time for him to say how great he is.
All right. Well. Point taken. Point taken.
Yes, because good heavens, if the man was any more in love with himself, you would think that his favorite cartoon show in the '80s was He-Man and the Masturbators of the Universe.
He'll be here all week, folks.
Yes.
Suddenly, the horn has folded space and wound up in the Catskills.
Yes. Please tip your waitress and please tip the horn, because there's not many venues like this out there. But Trump will easily be torn apart by Bernie Sanders in a debate. I believe Hillary Clinton can do it, but there is an enthusiasm gap for Secretary Senator Clinton. She's not attracting the young people as much as she would hope. It seems the Hispanics broke for Bernie in Nevada, and I don't think Super Tuesday will be quite as easy as she and her handlers would like. But in the end, we have to remember we can make change and have hope. In the end, it's up to us.
Well, it is entirely, Will. It is entirely. Well, it's lovely talking to you this evening.
Have a great night, and let's hope for a good week for everyone at the horn.
Absolutely. Thank you, Will. Thank you for all the goodwill that you bring to the program. You see what I did there, right?
Yes, yes. And remember, a fool and his penny may be soon separated, but a wise man and his money might want to donate to the horn tonight.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Thank you kindly, Will. Good to talk to you.
Bye.
Our buddy Will from Chicago. And happy news. The challenge has been met. Thomas's Have a Match, Start a Fire challenge has been met. And in terms of fundraising this evening, we have... wait a minute. Yeah, we've got $70 to go. $70 to go to come even here this 23rd day of February. So that's great. Thank you very kindly to anonymous number two, pending being told that I can say otherwise, and to Henry. Thank you very kindly. And to anonymous number one for getting us started, and to Thomas for the Have a Match, Light a Fire challenge. We got $70 to go. Awesome. Thank you. Let's see here. Going right back to the phones in a second. I didn't know that. Apparently, tzatziki is a Greek thing, and you generally don't get it served with the other food cultures of the wider region. The phenomenon of serving tzatziki with Middle Eastern food is uniquely North American. Well, I love tzatziki, and frankly, like a couple of other sauces that I dearly love, I can imagine I could probably have it on vanilla ice cream. You may recall years back conversations with our dear friend Kate of the Front Range, who at the time was down south in doing Katrina recovery, talking about learning about the predilection for putting Crystal hot sauce on your vanilla ice cream. And you know what? It works. Okay, let's, by the way, in terms of the philosophy toaster, Steve in New York suggests we need to be a little more highfalutin. How about a philosophy crepes maker? And I suggested a philosophy brioche toaster or something. But yes, it calls for something a little upmarket, I do believe. Let's run over to the stress line, where I suspect we have Harry. Are you there, Harry?
Yes, your suspicion is correct, Bob. Thank you very much. I wish I had some good food porn to report on or talk about tonight, and I'm sorry to have to disappoint your listeners. I'm actually deeply impressed, Tony, considering that I cannot contribute, that so many people have contributed tonight, and I think it's great that you're so close to your goal for the night. I just had a few brief things. They're all slightly different subjects. But anyway, first, a little bit of publishing news, which is relevant to some of your audience and a few people in particular. Today was the official publication date of a new book by Thomas Frank called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And
now, this is the same guy who gave us What's the Matter with Kansas, right?
That's right. I'm sorry. Yes, I do want to say, first of all, this is indeed the famous or semi-famous Thomas Frank, author of the famous or semi-famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And I mentioned it for two reasons. First of all, there is an excerpt that was already posted a few days ago on Harper's Magazine's website. It's actually in their on their blog page, which is called Browsings. And I think, as I recall correctly, the excerpt, they say it's an excerpt from the book, but the excerpt is entitled, No Lender B. And basically, and I haven't looked at the table of contents of the whole book, but from this excerpt, one gets the sense that he is basically trying to call liberals to task, particularly wealthy liberals. And the excerpt, I don't want to spoil all of it, but it basically is about, well, it's related to the Clinton Foundation's sponsoring of a particular event that Mr. Franks attended that had to do with celebrating, in part, the philosophy or the idea concept of micro-lending, which, as you may recall, a few years ago was very big in sort of third world development circles. And he is able to sort of, and he describes basically the event, which was a very sort of a public kind of almost staged event, and where Hillary Clinton was there and her daughter and some other, actually mostly other women. And part of this was about, supposedly about empowerment of women, but Mr. Franks, being a very smart and perceptive man, sort of shows it for what it is. So I just wanted to mention that to people, that his new book is out, and it is clear that he is basically trying to show that you can call yourself a liberal, and particularly if you're wealthy, but that really, well, that's hardly good enough. And you can try to act as if you are and do things that make you look like you're a liberal and wealthy. But as he says at the end of this excerpt, basically, it almost, something to the effect of, you know, it almost feels real or almost looks real. But, of course, it isn't.
Oh, you know, it would be, I would love to get him, and maybe, you know, there's nothing like having a new book out to entice people to do interviews. Well, I think it would be wonderful to get him on the program if we could.
Well, as you know, you have a number, I'm sure, of listeners and correspondents in Kansas, Dan, but you have one particular correspondent who, as we all recall, not only spent some personal time with Mr. Franks inside a restaurant, but also spent some personal time on the sidewalks of a famous university city.
Indeed, indeed.
And so I was reminded of that today when I saw this excerpt and saw that this book, the official publishing date of this book was today. And I'm hoping that certain correspondent perhaps may feel moved to perhaps help you out on that. And should I say what I'm talking about? I mean, maybe most people.
No. I think everybody knows. We're talking about one of a lovely conversation with the marvelously coherent Diane from Kansas, Stan, from a time back.
Exactly. Where she ended up having going to dinner with Mr. Franks, and then they had also some very interesting conversation out on the sidewalks of the town there. So anyway, which I thought was very charming. And anyway, so that's one thing. Second of all, you know, we were talking about culture, and John, our friend, the truck driver, I gather, is now in Texas.
Who, by the way, Harry, I just have to work this in here. Whom the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan, refers to as our road scholar. Ah, see what you did there?
Well, you know, from one academic to another, right?
Precisely.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I hadn't heard that. But they are indeed colleagues. The second thing I wanted to bring up was this issue about culture, you know, and what tips it or what people remember, you know. And you mentioned Clarence Darrow's closing argument in the Leopold and Loeb case. And, you know, it's, to me, it's interesting. I did a little bit of work on this when I lived in Washington. And, you know, child abuse, I mean, the first, actually, case of basically prosecuted child abuse appears in the U.S. to have been around, or at least documented case, was in New York City in around the late 1850s or early 1860s. And amazingly enough, the only people who were sort of willing to be involved were the leaders of the New York City Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, including, I believe, their president at the time, whose name was Elbridge Gerry of the famous Gerry family. And that then led to the New York City having the first Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And it's basically the same people. But, you know, then you had the progressives and, you know, and Darrow, in a sense, or that case certainly was of that era. And he and other progressives kind of got it. You know, there was a one of the first juvenile court judges in the United States was a man named Ben Lindsay, who I believe was had a court in Denver. And he basically pretty much devoted himself to juvenile cases. And he wrote one or two books about it. And he was, you know, he felt very, he was a very humane man. And he also, I think, would have agreed about this idea about violence begetting violence. And then, you know, things went, and then it sort of fell back maybe a little bit into obscurity. And the thing is, though, you know, if people think there was no child abuse, let's say, in the golden 50s or whatever, well, they're wrong. I mean, in fact, what part of the history of it is that in the early 1960s, a radiologist, and also again in Denver, and Henry Kempe, realized that children were being brought into the emergency rooms with injury, bone injuries, you know, broken legs, broken arms, whatever, that just didn't seem quite right. And what happened was that radiologists and the training under him and others basically realized that they could figure out from, you know, these injuries in the emergency room whether, in fact, it was an accident or whether, in fact, let's say, a child had been pushed down the stairs. And so for the first time, there was actually this medical evidence, in a way, of child abuse, because you could see it in the x-rays. And that, in a sense, led to a sort of a modern revolution about child abuse. And there's also a great story about Walter Mondale, when Richard Nixon was president. Walter Mondale really wanted to pass a bill to protect children. Also, I think it had to do with nutrition. And he drafted a bill, tried to get it through, and Nixon vetoed it. So the story goes, this is according to a scholar of child abuse named Barbara Nelson, the story goes that Mondale said, well, hey, you know, I think I'll recraft this as basically a bill about child abuse. And he did. It's called CAPTA. In fact, it still exists. And Mondale was quoted at the time as saying, you know, not even Richard Nixon can be against, you know, preventing child abuse. And he was right, because Nixon signed the bill. So, you know, and as you may know, there's still about, I think maybe it's down to 18 states where corporal punishment is still legal in schools. And, of course, these are mostly, almost all southern states. But, you know, that's a big number. It was up to 20 a few years ago, now it's down to like 19 or 18. And so, you know, culturally, well, you know, at least certain parts of the country, we have a long way to go. On the other hand, you know, there have been these tipping points that have helped, you know, people change that culture. And so I'm not sure there was any, you know, golden age, certainly not about spanking or anything else. I mean, even that, I think, was controversial.
No, but Harry, I think whether it's 18 states, 19 or 17.
Yeah.
You know, it does go back. This is one of those that I find very easy to go back to trace back to our Calvinistic puritanical roots.
Yeah,
and right. And I think it It goes back to England. It goes back to France.
Yes, and, you know, indeed, there was a, well, she's died a few years ago. There was a Swiss psychoanalyst who actually resigned from the International Psychoanalytic Association because of her views, Alice Miller, who was well known for writing books about the kinds of cultural, you know, violence perpetuated by child abuse in not only Germany, but yes, France, Greece, other places.
But the thing is, they got over it.
Well, although she, you know, she studied cases of, for example, of, you know, a few mass murderers or serial killers, and this was, you know, maybe no more than 20 or 30 years ago. And she was able to find, you know, that really most of these cases, perhaps she would say all, these children had been, you know, basically abused, were abused by their parents or by other relatives. I mean, brutally so. And, you know, the violence didn't just come out of nowhere, I guess is what she would certainly say. And, you know, and frankly, we certainly, it seems to be the case, for example, that certainly Adolf Hitler was treated very cruelly by his father.
Alois, yes. You won't mind if I say 8:36 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Who had 8:36? Damn it, Gerald. But the thing is, and it's not, it seems there are reasons why in my memory it feels like yesterday, but, you know, I was sort of thrust into a situation as a relatively young man, you know, 30-ish, where I saw things that I could scarcely imagine with my little white bread middle class upbringing that still happened out there. I will never forget the first time I learned what a spiral fracture was. And I saw it in the femur of a 3-month-old. And the autopsy photos are with me inside the little miracle that is the human memory to this day. And it was maybe a year or so later that I learned about a couple who were themselves victims of abuse, who had previously been raising children in a converted chicken coop, who had another child whom they allowed to smother because they were worried because it was cold outside. It was the most brutal, harsh, cold part of winter here. And so they turned up the gas heater as high as it would go,
and
baked their newborn.
Ah, well, that's horrific.
And everybody sitting around that table was weeping. What do you say about a culture, Harry, that treats that as an aberration instead of saying of such a thing, we must make policy that says that this is simply intolerable to ever have happen again?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if we were to, in that great democratic socialist future that so many seem scared to death of,
yeah.
If we were to adequately pay frontline social workers,
yes,
and hire a whole lot more of them,
yes, absolutely.
It goes without saying that there would be some godforsaken Republican out there, Harry, who would say, "Well, that's what you get with your nanny state."
Well,
you
yeah,
know, I'm all for a nanny state that keeps people with less than all the intellectual toolbox they need from unintentionally killing their children.
Oh, absolutely. No, look, the District of Columbia was under, you know, was being monitored by a federal judge for a long time because they hadn't, you know, didn't have enough social work staff to prevent this kind of thing. And also, I think it happened in Maryland as well. So, it's clear. No, you have to have that state. And in fact, Sweden, you know, has done that. They have laws against hitting children. So, you know, I mean, it can be done. But yes, you're right.
But again, to try to advance that in this country?
Oh, yeah. No, I yes, no. But yes, your point is very well taken. Absolutely. I don't, and I wish, you know, I don't know how to, you know, get rid of that hatred of the state, you know, or the hatred of government.
Well, Harry, I don't think we can get rid of it until we absolutely get all the way down to the ground with figuring out where it comes from. And you know, I fall back on Dr. Bill. Is this where we go back and read Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics?
Yeah. Well, yeah, at least. And, well, probably further back than that. Probably back to the Federalist Papers, I would assume, since those were propaganda anyway.
Or do we talk about Elizabethan Shakespearean England, where infant mortality was at such a high rate,
right,
that babies were basically swaddled and hung on a peg until they could get themselves down?
Yes, and no. I mean, certainly, in fact, you know, there are authors, famous authors, written about, in fact, you know, that there really was no childhood for children if you go back to the parts of the Middle Ages.
No, for lack of a better term, the cult of the child only arises out in white European culture, if I'm not mistaken, only arises out of white Victorian England and the U.S.
Yeah, I believe that's about right, yeah. No, there's an author, what is his name, Philippe Ariès, who wrote, a Frenchman, but he wrote a book about, you know, the history of childhood, and it's true that, you know, in terms of human civilization, it came pretty late.
But yeah. the ironic thing is that cultures deemed by white European colonialists to be savages, to be barbarians, had a far better track record with their own children.
Are you talking about Native Americans?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No, in fact, I know that to be true. And in fact, I once, a long time ago, I had an email exchange with a professor out in the Midwest who was Native American, and that was one of his programs. Yeah, no, the Native Americans were, and even I'm sure that time, in a sense, were much more respectful and worshipful. I know that in some Native American cultures, what is it, they believe the children somehow were coming back from heaven or something. I mean, they had this great, great, some of them, deep, deep, you know, respect that they needed, the children had, because they were considered somehow, you know, coming down from the heavens. And of course, we're also
talking about tribal peoples who very carefully managed the size of their populations.
Well, that's true too. Yes. Yeah.
But then again, to go back to dear old Shakespeare, I think of the, because it's one of, for my money, it's one of the most brutal passages in our literary tradition. The speech in Henry V before the gates of Harfleur, in which Henry V, who was known, understood in that time period as being a most pious and upright and puissant Catholic monarch, in which Henry V, he tells them that if they do not surrender the besieged city of Harfleur, that they will see their white bearded old men's heads spitted upon pikes, and that the shrill shrieking mothers will watch as his army dashes the brains of their infants out against the walls of the city.
Yeah.
Tell me again about European civilization, Harry.
No, I won't. I was just going to say that we your own Rhodes Scholarship is coming through tonight, and as always, but certainly talking about this. And I don't want to keep you, but I do would just like to say again, Bob, that just asking your listeners that in terms of the future of radio media, that I'm just going to say this, that basically in my view, the future is someone like you who is not only committed to doing programming, 5 days a week, always in a sense, same time and regularly, and also someone who is the epitome of empathy, being empathetic to your listeners. And also, I do believe also that indeed your form, which seems that you invented, of long form conversation radio. I think even if things start to boil over and fall apart, and if we all head for the hills, I think that your radio programming and your program here on these nights are going to be even more and more important to us, because you're going to be interacting and listening to people out there, instead of just talking one way.
With all the sincerity of my being, Harry, I thank you for those kind words. And if you will, if you'll permit me, I don't think I've ever mentioned this, but we talk about conversation radio, and just to give people an idea of where it comes from, because I don't think I've ever fully elaborated on it.
But, I'd love to hear it.
Well, my dad, I've talked about how he worked rotating shifts at the furnace.
Yes.
And that meant that sometimes he'd be coming home at 5 in the afternoon, other times he'd be coming home at 1 in the morning, and other times he would be, 4 to 12, 8 to 4, and then other times he'd be coming home at 9 in the morning. Well, on those, and this goes back to my infancy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little 3-bedroom house, and with me being the newbie, and there being 3 girls and another boy, space was at a premium, so my crib was in my parents' room.
Yeah.
And so when my father would come home from the 4 to 12, I would get up and scramble over the bars of what was probably a freaking death trap of a crib, because, no Consumer Product Safety Commission back then, because, freedom and liberty.
Oh, no.
And my dad would often bring home hamburgers and really, really good coffee from a little place called the Pit Grill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there were nights that both of my mother and my father looked at me and went, "Go to sleep, kid." But it's a precious memory, because I would get up, scramble between them, and they would share bites of their cheeseburger. I didn't get the coffee, because that coffee will stunt your growth. But I'd get little bites of cheeseburger, because by then I was eating solid food. And if my father had been and there was a bedside radio, and my father would listen to late night radio. And if there was an interview going on with which he was particularly engaged, he would turn on that bedside radio to the same station that he was listening to, and we would sit there listening to the radio, because of course they were Depression people, and they had that cultural tradition, for lack of a better phrase, of listening to the radio.
Yeah,
they didn't necessarily need to have a visual image pumped at them at the same time.
Absolutely.
Right. And so he would finish off what he had already been listening to in the car on the way home. And years later, when I would go and become a little pimply-faced gospel DJ, I too would be coming home at 12:30 at night. And by then, it's Larry King. Larry King's come into his prominence on the Mutual Broadcasting Network. Beep.
Right.
You got to make that noise. Beep. That was before subaudible tones. And I would listen, and what I would hear was the degree of interest, and I always thought he was much better on radio than on television. But I would hear the degree of interest that he poured into the dignitaries that he talked to. And then, you know, he'd open up the lines and take calls from, you know, ordinary people. But that was just bang, 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 get on, get off, you're done.
Yeah, exactly.
And so over the course of the years, and then, I wound up at stations where we were running it, and I would have to sit there and listen to the whole program night after night after night after night. And I developed a real, for lack of a better term, reverence for the concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started envisioning doing this,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to hear more
mm-hmm.
of the ordinary people. And I asked myself, what would it be like if you carried on conversations with just regular folks
mm-hmm.
and you offered them the same breadth of time that gets offered to the under-deputy secretary for royal table linens?
Well, you know, it reminds me right away of basically a community of people. You know, I mean, it's sitting around, you know, around a dinner table or elsewhere. And, I myself have always been much more of a radio person than a TV person, which is one of the reasons that I stopped watching TV, although I, you know, still love audio programs of various kinds. And I certainly, I don't want to keep you much longer, but I just think that it seems as if, frankly, you are the only person regularly doing this kind of, you know, radio modality. And I do think that whatever happens, I do think in the future, progressive radio is the kind of, you know, mutual or, you know, conversation and the empathy that you bring to all of your callers, whoever they are. And I just hope that I can't foretell the future, but I just have this feeling that, I hope that everyone, you know, sees that we are going to need, you know, you and perhaps a few other people like you, but you are the, you know, you're the person who's leading the way, at least in my humble opinion. And I just, you know, I'm looking forward to the future of progressive radio and you, you know, in a sense, leading a movement so that we're, in a sense, everybody is talking to each other instead of just listening, you know, to someone, whether he's trustworthy or not. Now, in your case, you're, you know, both empathetic and trustworthy and authentic and, you know, and honest. So I never worry. But, you know, as I said, I think it's a concept of moving forward in this country, you know, as it seems like there's this, you know, push towards greater democracy and sort of leveling and more, you know, egalitarian or equal ways of doing things. I think all I can say is I'm very hopeful for the future of your network and your program.
I hope so as well. And, you know, one of these days we'll get some of the phone issues sorted out a little bit better. I'd love to have the six lines that we used to have coming in here.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's, God only knows, a ton of money.
Please, rich listeners, please donate so Bob can get his equipment back to where it used to be.
But there's such a depth of depth of feeling in this conversation. I'll say this: I come to the microphone every night, hoping that the time spent owing a duty to anybody who tunes in, not to waste their time and not to soft soap anything and to carry on a little bit, sure, but maybe somewhere along the way to make some significant observations, some meaningful points. And frankly, I've been I've been disturbed about this notion that I'm being perceived as Hillary bashing. I mean, it has kept me awake at night.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Because I do bring that depth of concern to what goes on here. I don't ever open this microphone up wanting to hurt, to deliberately hurt anyone who who takes the time to share theirs to partake of the program.
No, in fact, I think I would say that you are the most empathetic radio talk show host I know of. Really.
Now, to be fair, I don't give a tinker's damn about the oligarchs and the plutocrats. I wouldn't lose a wink of sleep if I thought that if I thought that Chuck Koch was sitting out there going, "Damn, that Bob Kincaid just doesn't understand me." No, sorry.
Yeah.
But the people who form this community, that's a different story altogether. We didn't build this community to tear it apart in the name of partisan politics during a primary season.
Oh no, and frankly, as I said, I think that the qualities of empathy that you have, it seems, always had, I think would, if anything, prevent that from ever happening. I'm not worried, but I'm sorry that other people are, but I'm certainly not worried.
Well, I thank you, Harry, for a lovely conversation. Every time you call, it is exactly that. You bring a lot of intellectual and emotional heft to the conversation, and I want you to know I value it.
Well, I'm privileged, frankly, to be a listener and a member of the Horn community. I really am. I've always felt that way since I started listening in 2011. I just feel very privileged. And with that, I know you need to go, so I'm going to let you go.
Yep, I've run you right up to the end of the program. I'm also a very self-centered person. So.
No, I've been watching my watch, so I know you need to go. I should let you get off.
All right, take care, Harry.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our buddy Harry calling from Baltimore on the stress line. And again, I don't know why the stress line works for some people and some people it doesn't. I don't know. But, hey, prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow. And if between now and then we can scrounge up $70, we'll go into the program even, just needing to raise our usual little $200. So thank you very kindly to two anonymous contributors for their help. Thank you to Henry, and thank you to Thomas for the Have a Match, Start a Fire challenge. It made a tremendous difference this evening. And sincerely, thank you, one and all, for your thoughts, your observations. Thank you. Thank you for the time you spend with us. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch. Wow, thank you, Ben Birch, for getting us back on the air this evening. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.